Aren't you glad we stopped and heard that? Thanks so much. I appreciate it. And it's nice to be here with you this evening. And it makes me remember that back when I was in academy and visiting speakers would come by, all too often, one or two things would go wrong. They'd either bore us to death with tired cliches, or they'd try to entertain us. And the problem with that one was, if we wanted to get entertained, we could go turn on the tube and have it done by a pro. Oh, there was one other thing they did. They talked too long. Now, I'm going to do my dead level best to make none of those mistakes tonight. Because I well remember that what some visiting speakers used to seem to be saying is that, bless your hearts, young folk, you can't really handle a big issue by yourselves. Well, I think you can. As a matter of fact, I think you folk can handle major issues better than a lot of adults can. See, you have an advantage. A lot of adults have been around the course enough times and compromised with truth enough times that they've lost what you have. And that is the ability to punch through baloney and see instantly what's real and what isn't real. Adults of older years can be fooled. If you got any questions about that, just listen to the candidates in a political election and then watch the adults clap for them. They can be fooled. I don't think you can. Now, as Ms. Collins said, I'm not a preacher, I'm a lawyer. And if I had a client where the issues were really big, where life itself was at stake, where you just didn't dare let the ball get dropped, and if our crazy legal system would let me pick the perfect jury, you want to know who I would choose? I'd choose 12 of you. Because there is something in the teenage mind that can sense truth. If my client really needed truth to be discovered, I would pick you because I could trust you to find the truth, and then I could trust you to know what to do with it. Well, in a sense tonight, I think you are a jury. And I think the jury is out. And I think you got a critical question you have to decide. All this talk, the coming of Christ, the Advent message, Adventism, all that it stands for, all this stuff you've heard as long as most of you can remember, from parents and Sabbath school teachers and academy Bible teachers and anybody else who got in a place like this and talked to you. The question you have to be asking is all this stuff real? Does it really matter to me? That's the question you have to deal with. So I think you are a jury, and I think the jury's out. And tonight I don't propose to answer that question for you. I'd just like to share with you some facts, and maybe you'd like to make your own minds up as you think about it. With that in mind, let's go back just a little over 2 years. You go back to May of 1991, actually not quite 2 years yet. And in the Soviet Union, there is a cosmonaut, third class, by the name of Sergei Krikalev. And he has flown down to the Baikonur Cosmodrome in the central USSR. He's made it up with one of their Energia rockets, and they launch him into orbit. And he rendezvous with their Mir space station, and his mission is to stay up there for about 6 months and do whatever scientific and military procedures have been assigned to him to do. So the guy climbs aboard, the hatches are sealed, he establishes radio contact with the USSR, and he goes to work. Well, summertime goes by in the year of 1991, and every 90 minutes he's going over the same spot in the world. And when the cloud cover parts and he happens to be over Mother Russia, he can look down at that just awesomely huge expanse of land that Russians call a Rodina, the motherland. It covers nearly half the earth. It's 11 time zones. And down there it slowly creeps by brown and blue and white. And then the clouds close in again, and for a while he can't see home. And the weeks go by, and as the summer of 91 goes by, it must have seemed to that, isolated cosmonaut, that the world about 100 miles below him was going crazy. Come August, he hears bits and pieces of news that Comrade Gorbachev is under house arrest in southern Russia. And the real problem occurs in October when he's supposed to come home. And he gets the kind of message that no military officer ever likes to hear. Believe me, I know, I've been there. The message is, Comrade Krikalev, your return date has been extended. We will advise you when we are ready to have you return to Earth. Well, the blunt truth of it was, the reason they couldn't bring him back down was the country was too broke to bring him down. Couldn't afford it. They couldn't afford to launch his replacement. And so Krikalev goes around and around the world, and pretty soon, when the cloud cover parts, he looks down and Mother Russia's turning white. And January comes and the new year dawns, 1992, and he's still orbiting the Earth. He's going around and around as the months go by, and pretty soon he looks down in southern Russia, down where those big mountains start to come up from the plains of Georgia, down near Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan, and he sees in the plains of southern Russia little kind of dirty brown holes where the sunlight is beginning to erode the ice and snow, and springtime's coming, and the guy's still in orbit. Now, finally, well into 1992, they get their act together. He gets into his ablative reentry vehicle. He rockets back, parachutes into the center of this landmass he's been looking at. And he does so to a time warp I don't think anybody's ever faced in the history of the world. The country that launched him, the USSR, is gone. His hometown of Leningrad is now St. Petersburg. Comrade Gorbachev is now a capitalist of all things, signing million-dollar contracts for books and appearances. His uniform, which once bore the proud insignia of the USSR, Soyuz Sovietskiy Socialistichestik Respublik, that thing is now a museum piece. Now, let's stop right here and do this right. Where's Wes? Wes going to help me here? Come on up. At least you deserve to see what this looks like on somebody. Got it? Now, there's a good-looking Russian, right? Now, you'll notice something here from his insignia. If he was an ordinary Russian soldier, right here on the epaulette, you wouldn't see two gold stars. You would see what looks like a C and an A. That's a Russian S and A, stands for Sovietskaya Armia, Soviet Army. The one that wore this particular uniform was very special. He was an officer in the Strategic Rocket Forces. I know because I've met the guy in Moscow, and he had in his particular unit two big rockets. One of them was liquid-fueled, one of them was solid-fueled. The probabilities are that they were both aimed across the pole, the distant, very mysterious place called America. Thank you, Wes. I appreciate it. So Krikalev comes back to Earth, and he discovers that his monthly salary will not even buy a pair of shoes. Now, all of that has happened in 10 months. Now, those of you who managed to stay awake in history class, notice something. Hardly ever in the history of the world has any country with the kind of military power that the Soviet Union possessed, ever gone down to that kind of defeat without using every weapon in their arsenal. And they're gone, and hardly a shot is fired. Now, the question you might want to be asking is why? And to answer that, let me take you back just a little earlier in time. It'll put a lot of you back in your early years. You're starting school, but you're aware of these things. You will have heard about it on the news. And we're going back now to June 7 of 1982, just 11 years ago come June. And in the country of Italy, it's beginning to be early summertime. And if you're in Rome and you go to Vatican City, as you walk in towards St. Peter's, the papal apartments will be on your right. If they let you in, and it's not that hard to get in, believe it or not, security is not really as tight as you might expect. If you will walk down a long corridor to the end of one of those long buildings, you will find yourselves in a very interesting room. At one end of it, there's this big carved marble fireplace. On the floor is a oriental rug in very tasteful rose and black, and in the room are a couple of very fancy carved chairs. And on June 7 of 1982, two men are seated in those chairs, and they are all alone. One of them wears a plain brown business suit. The other one is wearing the white and gold regalia of the reigning Pope. And the Pope is seated with his elbow on the arm of the chair, and his chin is resting on his hand, and he looks exactly like a kindly old parish priest hearing confession. And the two men are talking, and the other individual there is the President of the United States. Well, those two men have a lot in common in June of 82. You see, within the last few months, both of them have suffered a gunshot. Both of them have come literally millimeters from death. Both of them are convinced that God has spared them miraculously and that He now has a special work for them to do. And both have come to the conclusion that they know what the job is. They believe it's time to rewrite the whole map of the world, to change human history, to get rid of communism, and bring in something called a new world order. In other words, to bring in the first safe global government the world has ever seen. Now, in the head of one of those men was a plan as to how that might be done. And the one with the plan was not the President of the United States. The plan was in the mind of an individual that a billion people refer to as the Holy Father. Now, it's not very often we get a look inside the head of a famous world figure like that this soon after a major change occurs. We happen to know all of this simply because an ex-Jesuit priest and Vatican insider has written a book all about it. And it's a book you've no doubt seen or heard about. What I'm going to read you now is probably something you have heard read before, but it's worth listening to because it tells you what happened to the Soviet Union and why it happened. And it's the very first page of the text of the book by Malachi Martin, Keys of This Blood. And he begins as follows. Willing or not, ready or not, we are all involved in a global competition about who will establish the first one world system of government that has ever existed. Once the competition has been decided, the world and all that's in it, our way of life as individuals, our families and our jobs, our trade and commerce, our religions, even our badges of national identity, in other words, our flags, all will have been powerfully and radically altered forever. No one can be exempted from its effects. No sector of our lives will remain untouched. That was the dream of the Pope on a June day in 1982. But it didn't end there. It went a little further. You turn a few pages over here in this same book to page 492, and we go on to learn that the Pope was convinced that a one-world government could only work successfully if, in fact, it was based on the principles of the Roman Catholic faith. Let me read it to you. The Pope insists that men have no reliable hope of creating a viable, workable geopolitical system unless it is on the basis of Roman Catholic Christianity. So there is the dream. Those who think of him as His Holiness would come to the conclusion that the Pope has a dream of returning to a world essentially governed under the principles of the Roman Catholic faith. Well, that's what they were talking about that June day. Now, the question that I have for you is this. What's wrong in that picture? Go back to June 82, and the Pope is saying it's time to get rid of communism and establish a Christian-oriented world, and there's something wrong in that picture because there's something in the way. What is it? It's a massive country called the Soviet Union. See, back in 82, the guy in charge of Russia is this big, kind of a dour-faced bear of a man by the name of Leonid Brezhnev. And they are building weapons at a rate you can hardly comprehend. I mean, they're building this awesome Typhoon submarine. The thing is gigantic. When one of our naval officers went aboard the thing, he stood on the dock and looked up at it, and the Soviet officers were on the quarterdeck looking down, and he said, "That isn't a ship, it's a mountain." And everybody had a good-natured laugh. It is gigantic. Now, at the same time, they were working on mating stuff like the SSNX-24 cruise missile to their submarine force. That doesn't mean much to you, except that it reduces our warning time of a nuclear attack to like 5 minutes. When that thing comes out from the water and ignites and starts inland, you don't have much more than 5 minutes warning time when you first pick it up on radar, if you ever do. Well, they were deploying other weapons like the SS-18 that you heard President Bush talking about recently. That's the big one with the 10 bombs aboard. All of them are powerful enough to destroy either a city or a hardened missile silo. Now, I happen to know all this stuff kind of by accident. It was back about 82 when all of this was happening. I got a letter from a West Coast senator, Western senator, and he said, "Would you like to join a kind of an interdisciplinary think tank that the Congress is establishing on national defense?" And quite frankly, I wondered what in the world a man was writing me for, because I hadn't had to do much of this stuff for several years. And my wife finally told me, in fact brought me down to earth by saying, "Well, it's probably true. You have nothing whatever to offer them, but if you go to the meetings, you'll learn something." So not able to argue with that kind of logic, I wrote the senator and said, "Well, I'll give it a try." So I went back to Washington, and there in Arlington, Virginia, we began to have briefings with various high government officials, including Cap Weinberger and Senator Tower and some of the others that were very much involved in national defense. Now, the point I'm getting to is this. In those days, the computers that our government has that play war games, the what-if games, what if they do this and we do that, what would the result be? Those computers were coming up with some things we didn't like to hear. They were saying that the Russians now had such a strong offensive nuclear rocket force that if they decided to hit us first, we would lose so many people and have so little effective damage we could do to the Soviet Union that the president's only realistic recourse might be to pick the red telephone up, call Comrade Brezhnev and say, "Sir, what can we do toward ending the war?" That's how close we came. So that in June of 82, when this good gentleman says it's time to wipe communism off the face of the earth, there's no rational way to do it. You burn the world down if you try. But the good man has an idea. Like a lot of successful tacticians, he says, "I don't dare attack them from the outside. It's too dangerous. But the enemy I cannot attack from without, I may be able to destroy from where?" From within. And inside Eastern Europe, he has a structure already made to do the job he thinks needs to be done, and it is called the Mother Church. See, all across Eastern Europe, there are people who remember the years before World War II when they still had a flag and freedom and the ability to go to mass whenever they wanted to without any political commissar breathing down their necks. And I got a little sense of what that must have been like to live under that system. I was down in southern Russia in the little town of Pyatigorsk one day. I was walking across the village park. There was a pretty little park, and there were flowers out, and I had a little pocket camera. And I thought, "Well, I'm going to get a picture of this park." And I was walking, and I never stopped walking. I just picked the camera up, opened the lens, took a picture, never stopping to think that there was a man and his little girl walking about 15 feet ahead of me. The little girl heard the camera shutter go click, and she looked around. And then I realized what I had done. I quickly shut the camera up, put it in my pocket. She said something in Russian to her dad, couldn't quite get it because they were a little distance away. He turned around, gave me one quick look, and the two of them hastened their pace. They never looked back again. They just hurried home. See, they thought I probably was assembling a file on them. That's what it's like to live there. So there is within Eastern Europe this thing called the church, and the Pope is saying, I can use that thing because there are still people there that remember what it's like to be free. And so he says, I can destabilize places like Poland and Hungary and Czechoslovakia within the church, but I need an ally. I need some help. Now, it's a classic military principle. You may be able to defeat your enemy one-on-one, just face against face, you know, mano a mano. You may be able to pull that off, but it's a lot easier to get rid of your enemy if you can squish them. One force on one side and one force on the other. It's militarily the old classic pincers movement. You just squash them to death. The Pope is saying, I can get them from the inside, Mr. President. What could you do from the outside? And they cook up this idea that it's time for the United States to declare war on the Soviet Union. Only we're not going to use bombs. We won't use bullets. Instead, we're going to use dollars and rubles. And President Reagan comes back from that conference and he says, I want a 600-ship Navy. I want to revamp our military forces. And by the way, I want to try something called Star Wars. It's going to be real expensive, but I think it can win the war against the Soviets. You bet it could, because they couldn't afford to match us with that kind of technology. Now, Brezhnev knew it. And all across Russia and the whole East Bloc, people went into the streets by the hundreds of thousands protesting things like Star Wars. Why? They knew if we went ahead with those programs, we would break their economy because they didn't dare put that kind of money into defense and they didn't dare not to. It was absolutely no win. So for about the next 10 years, things went on. In Eastern Europe, we began to send in stuff like fax machines and TV transmitters, printing presses, copying machines, stuff to communicate with a lot of people. The CIA, American labor unions, and Solidarity worked together, and hand in hand with them was the local parish priest helping to get this stuff distributed to the faithful. And pretty soon they were just driving the communists nuts. Once in a while, for example, on a state TV program, they might be broadcasting the Warsaw or the Krakow soccer match. And in a blank moment in the program, on the screen would come the word, Solidarity lives, resist. It'd stay there for maybe like 10 seconds. They'd shut that transmitter down, put it in somebody's van and scoot it out of town. And before the Ruskies could triangulate in on that transmission and figure out where it's coming from, it's off the air and it's gone. And they start to flood the country with propaganda, books, material, the information grapevine begins to go. And from inside, the church begins to destroy the communist system, while from the outside, the mighty economic pressure of the United States squashes from the other direction. And in 10 years, Eastern Europe can't stand it anymore. And country by country, they start to fall. Now, there was a saying in Eastern Europe. It took 10 years for Poland, 10 months for Hungary, 10 weeks for Eastern Germany, 10 days for Czechoslovakia. That's how fast it came. Well, Time magazine put it this way. Step by reluctant step, the Soviet and communist government of Poland bowed to the moral, economic, and political pressure imposed by the Pope and the President. Jails were emptied. The country's economy collapsed in strikes and demonstrations and economic sanctions. In the summer of 87, Pope John Paul II was cheered by millions across Poland. And within a very short time, within the length of time it takes to launch a cosmonaut and bring him down again a little late, this stuff was history. The fact is they lost World War III. We fought it in a way they couldn't win. Now, the question is, how bad did they lose? Let me just tell you what it's like to lose a war. I'm reading now from U.S. News and World Report. It says, the proud Soviet military machine that turned back Hitler at Stalingrad and challenged the West for 45 years has disintegrated. On some Russian bases, barracks have been turned into communal apartments in which 15 families huddle behind makeshift plywood walls, share one kitchen and one bathroom. They are so broke, they rent their tanks out overnight. Down in southern Russia, there's all kinds of fighting going on between various factions, various countries, various tribes. Soviet soldiers, ex-Soviet soldiers will rent their tanks out. They say there's only one provision, bring the thing back in time so we can have it here for morning inspection. And a Soviet general complained recently that he earned the equivalent of $12 a month and had to borrow the civilian suit he was wearing for a magazine interview. That's what it's like when you lose a war. I suppose it's most clearly described here in a little article that talks about how the common people are now living in Russia. They talk about the little Siberian city of Tumen. It's way out there in that frozen nothing that you call Siberia. And the writer puts it this way, outside the Tumen City Hall, a pathetic little market suggests that many are already at the point of desperation. Old men and women stand silently selling off their possessions. Blocks of ice hold down grubby cloths on which are displayed combs, buttons, bits of half-eaten food, a tattered scarf, a shoelace, two socks. A freezing wind is blowing, but few of the poorly clad vendors seem to notice. They have nothing else to sell, nowhere else to go, no safety net to save them. That's how bad they lost. And it was done because a great world church and a great world civil power got together in a coalition, and even the mighty Soviet Union couldn't resist that thing. Now let's talk about whether the Advent message has any meaning at all for you tonight. How about let's turn to Revelation 13. Revelation 13, beginning with about verse 11. And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spake how? As a dragon. And he doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on earth in the sight of men. And he causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand, or where? In the forehead. We'll talk about that one tomorrow morning. And that no man might buy or sell, save he that had the mark, the name, or the number. And then listen what else happens. He had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. Somewhere toward the end of time, Revelation makes it pretty clear. Some things come together in a recognizable way. One country in this world emerges as a predominantly powerful authority, and the whole world recognizes it. And by the way, its influence comes at least in part from high-tech power. You notice that reference to fire coming out of the sky and speaking like a dragon? In other words, this nation that emerges as a world leader has the physical punch to enforce what it says it wants to do. Well, around this nation, there's a global coalition forms up. Everybody is agreed upon some kind of global decision. And from the reference in Revelation 13 to that little word worship, it's pretty clear that religion figures into this in some way. So there's a global consensus that comes down with respect to some global religious point of view. And finally, notice something interesting. Those who don't go along face a progression of two very interesting remedies. Number one, they're cut off from global commerce. They're embargoed. Number two, if that doesn't work, the military forces of the world are turned loose and allowed to use lethal force. Now, think about it a little bit, and that's exactly the scenario we went through in the Persian Gulf. Not saying we shouldn't have done it, it wasn't, or that it wasn't necessary, but I'm saying I think history has done a dry run for what you see described in Revelation 13. Somebody got out of line bad. They needed to be stopped. And what was the world's reaction? Mr. Hussein, going to give you a little time to think about it. You don't buy or sell anymore. And if that doesn't work, we got something called cruise missiles and F-16s, and they will persuade you. And we may be using those again within hours in that same part of the world. Now, with that in mind, let's go back to the dream of that fascinating individual thought of by so many millions of people as His Holiness. Ready or not, willing or not, we are all involved in a no-holds-barred competition about who will establish the first one-world system of government that has ever existed. The men have no reliable hope of creating a viable political system unless it's on the basis of Roman Catholic Christianity. Once upon a time, back in the summer of 82, there was an obstacle in the way of that dream. The obstacle was called the Soviet Union. And it ain't there anymore. Now, can you think, as we close, of a couple of other obstacles that might just still be in the way of that dream? That dream of a one-world government, an orderly new system of government based on the principles of the Catholic faith? Yeah, I can think of a couple of obstacles. One of them is an old document. If you want to see it in person, you've got to go back to Washington, D.C. and go to the National Archives. And every day it comes up from its bomb-proof shelter because it's written on kind of old material. And it begins with these words, "We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, and ensure to ourselves and our posterity the blessings of liberty, do ordain and establish this Constitution." You know what the First Amendment to that document says? "Congress shall pass no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof." In the way of this dream, there's an older dream, that you and I have the right to be who we want to be and how we want to be. I can think of another obstacle that might also stand in the way. I can think of it because they're referred to in Malachi Martin's book. Let me read it to you from page 286. The second obstacle that he sees that stands in the way of this dream of a new, better world are little groups of individuals, little churches. They don't amount to much in the global scene, but they're there and they've been recognized. And in those situation rooms in the great corridors of power where people plan your future, they've been identified and classified and they're known about. Collectively, they have the name minimalist because they don't think a whole lot of people are going to go to heaven, just a few. Now, let me read it to you from the words of Malachi Martin. He says, "These people, these little churches, quote, have a deeply rooted enmity for all that John Paul represents. They all arose within the context of rebellion against the authority of the Roman Church. The vast majority of them are homegrown products of the United States. They have been formed in the very womb of Western democratic principles about the rights of man. They accept the latter-day American interpretation of the wall that separates church and state." And among those groups of people he's talking about and complaining about, would you like to guess who is specifically mentioned? Seventh-day Adventists. Couple of obstacles in the way of a powerful dream. A dream so big the Soviet Union couldn't hold it back. But you know, I can think of a third obstacle. That's what's between your ears. Because if in your mind you decide that you don't care to live in that kind of a world, then you are also an obstacle. And tomorrow morning we're going to talk about the ways in which the obstacle of your mind could be neutralized in the high-tech world of the future, in which your opinion doesn't really matter that much, and the future has already been written. Let's close with prayer, shall we? Heavenly Father, we thank you for the fact that we have been able to see this coming. Sometimes we're tempted to ask, does it really matter? Been talking about the Advent now for 150 years, and sometimes it's easy to wonder if it'll ever happen. Help us not to make the mistake of wondering that when it's happening all around us. In Jesus' name, amen.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright 2009, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.